Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Throw me a frickin' bone here. I'm the boss. Need the info.
All right, welcome back into the House of Mystery, and of course I'm Al Warren, and you're not. Mr. David Rose North Martino Smith is on the other side. You know, I don't know what he's doing over there.
Just adding names.
Holy holy donut!
Well, it depends on
you. Trying to get more zoning for more names.
Well, so here we go. We got you play one on the radio. That's I didn't use that. That's true. Well, anyway, today we've got another return. It's return week. Everybody's returning this week. And today, so we've got Mr. Alan Orloff, and he plays one on TV. So welcome, Al. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me back. I had fun last time, and I expect to have fun this time.
Well, we'll see what we can do. We'll see what we can pull off here. So what exactly do you play on TV?
Well, I don't play anything.
No.
But my character in my latest book called I Play One on TV, he does. He plays a murderer as a young kid, as a teenager, on one of these crime reenactment shows. And I won't spoil the plot, but bad things happen with other characters from that show. And he has to sort of find what the truth is and while still not losing his own life, as it were.
Wow. So this is kind of like a comedy.
No, it's a thriller, but there are some lighter moments. I think it's sort of campy myself. So that's sort of in the back of my head. It's kind of how I wrote it. Let me tell you how I came up with this idea, because I didn't really come up with the idea myself. Oh. I got an email from my agent at the time, and the email said something like, Alan, my wife and I, we watch crime reenactment shows on channels like Investigation Discovery on cable. Wouldn't it be cool if the protagonist was a teenager and he portrayed a murderer as a teenager on one of these shows, and somehow the murderer gets out of prison and comes back and hunts this guy down? Which, of course, is a fabulous premise for a book. Now, what my agent didn't know at the time was that I had a son who was an actor as a teenager. Still an actor. He portrayed a murderer as a kid on one of those crime reenactment shows on Investigation Discovery.
Wow.
So it was perfect. And the best thing was I didn't have to do any research because I lived through it. So, I mean, it was like, I couldn't believe it when it was, I mean, such a great premise. And I sort of, a little chagrin that I didn't think of it on my own, having it right under my nose for so many years.
Yeah, that's crazy. But your son never had to do any, he wasn't being chased by a killer. Or
not that I know of, no. That's where the fiction takes over from the reality.
Well, how do you know a good idea about like something like that? Is it just instinct or what?
You know, you're a writer. Most of the writers I know have so many ideas, and they just don't have enough time to write them all out, you know, explore them all. So for me, I think of an idea, and I sort of, you know, put it on the back burner. And if it keeps popping up, if I keep thinking about it, or you know, it comes to the top of my mind, you know, a week later or a month later, and I can't shake that idea, then I know that it's a possible one to pursue. A lot of the ideas, you know, they come and they go, and I never think twice about it. But if an idea sticks with me and I can't get rid of it, then that's a sign that it could be a keeper.
Is the idea more important than the characters?
Well, the idea usually has the characters involved. I'm not just talking plot. I'm talking about the whole thing. So for me, I can't really separate the plot from the characters too much because the characters drive the plot, and the plot sort of informs what the characters need to do. So it's sort of, you know, a symbiotic relationship. You know, what? different books have arrived in different fashions. Well, I wrote Pray for the Innocent, which you can see over my left shoulder there. I woke up with that idea fully formed in my head at 4 o'clock in the morning, which was, I'm telling you, freaky as all get out. But it stuck with me, and I you know, jotted down the outline, and I just put aside what I was working on, and I went forward with that. And, you know, it came out great. I was really happy with what happened. Now, every morning I wake up, I'm a little disappointed that I don't have that great idea, but small sacrifice.
Well, where do you think that came from? Where does something like that come from for you?
I wish I knew. I honestly, it's not like I was thinking about some elements of the idea or anything. It just came to me like, this is just, right. I mean, the human mind is just amazing. So,
well, certainly.
I don't know.
We see it every day. But I just wonder, so it just comes to you, and so you get up and you write it down, write down all you can remember. And does that come with characters and everything?
That one did. Yeah. Yeah. It was 99% fully formed. It was just freaky. And it wasn't a dream. It was just sort of, I woke up with the idea. So, I don't know. I try not to ask too many questions about it because
you don't want
to get snatched away.
Yeah, you don't want to spoil it, you know. You know, you're probably just drunk or something, hungover.
Probably.
You know, it was a movie playing in the background. And, you know, it's sort of crazy. But so now when you develop a character, do you take from people around you?
I think all writers, you know, at least observant ones, take bits, you know, pieces and snatches of various characters, whether it's, you know, a mannerism or a speech, you know, a way of certain characters, you know, speaks in a certain fashion, or maybe how someone looks, or, you know, maybe, you know, a neurotic trait. So I think most of the characters I write are probably amalgams of people I've met or people I've seen. I'm a great people watcher. So back in the day when you could go to the mall or go out in public, I would just sit there and sort of watch people go by. And I guess it all kind of gets cataloged back in there somewhere.
I've never been allowed in public. So
probably with good reason.
Yeah.
Well, I'm wondering, when you're creating these characters, do you, I hear voices when I write. Do you have an inner monologue in your head? Do you hear the characters' voices, or are you more translating like images and symbols into prose?
Well, that's a good question. I certainly, when I'm writing dialogue, I sort of try to put myself into someone's, another character's body. And so I hear their, how they would say it and their phraseology. I guess I hear voices in that respect. I'm not sure I hear them the same way that you hear them. Yeah. Probably a good thing.
Probably a good thing, yes.
Yeah. It's a little dangerous. He starts doing weird things. And he said, well, the voice told me to do it.
Mm. You don't need the medication.
No.
So I think it was Jeff Deaver who once was given a talk, and he said, sometimes my characters, I hear, he said he hears other writers tell him that the characters sort of take over and they do what they want to do. And Jeff said, if that ever happens to me, I just kill off the character because I'm the one who's in charge. So I'd like to stay in charge.
Oh, so
I like kill that.
Him. Yeah. Well, there you go. Well, so how long does it take you to put together? So this, I play one on TV. So when you got the idea from your agent, how long did it take you to actually put it down on paper, get it done?
Well, I have a certain, I've probably written, I published this, I Play One on TV was my 10th published book, and I probably have another 5 or 6 or 7 completed manuscripts. So I've completed, gone through the process of coming up with the idea, starting writing, going through, revising everything 16, 17, 18 times. And I like to say that each time it's the same, I use the same process, but it probably changes a little bit from time to time. But typically, if I get an idea, I will take about a week to sort of outline where I think it's going to go, and not really detailed, but sort of by scene. So, in this scene, Jim and Joan, they're in the coffee shop and they're talking about how to get rid of the body, at that kind of level. And then when I first started, I used to take some time and write character sketches for each of the main characters. So, I just went to the internet and I got some, like a checklist, a questionnaire, really. And I go through an answer. So what's your character drive? What kind of car do they drive? What's their favorite food? What do they like to do? Their hobbies? What do they have brothers and sisters? That kind of thing. And I found that gave me a good sense of who the characters were, kind of, so I could then write what motivates them and how they react to certain situations. I don't do that so much anymore. Once in a while, I'll sketch out some notes. So that takes a week doing the outline and any character kind of definitions. And then I decide how long I want to take to write this book. So typically my books are like 80,000 words or so. And if it's 3 months, that's whatever that is, 28,000, whatever, divided by, you divide 80 by 3, you get 28,000, 27,000, whatever, 23,000, what is it, 26,000. Anyway, and that's how much I have to write each month, and I'll divide it up by day. So I'll get a daily quota of words, and that's how I usually write. I write to like a daily word quota. So I'll sit down, and I'll just look at my outline, and I'll just start typing the first scene and then the second scene, so on. And I don't go back and edit while I'm writing, which a lot of writers do. They go back either from time to time or before they start the next writing session, they'll go back and edit the last 3 or 4 pages of what they've written the day before, for instance. That's just not how I do it. And so if I change a character's name, like in chapter 4 and then again in chapter 7 or something, and you were to read my first draft, you would be like, who are these people? And what happened to the main character? Because he used to be called, something, and now he's called, Jim. He was John, and now he's Jim, and now he's David, North Martino, whatever.
Rose.
So you're in my next book, David. I haven't met you yet, but you're going to be in.
Yeah.
We'll see if you get past the first chapter.
Yeah, I probably won't.
So I don't edit. I just go straight through. So my first draft is a mess, like a total mess. But I know it can take me, say, 2 months or 3 months. And usually I write, 1,200 words a day or 1,500 words a day. So it takes me about that 2 or 3 months to get a first draft. And then the work begins, because then you got to go back and make it make sense and do the revisions and so on. So I can probably, you know, write a complete book totally revised in 10 months, maybe. I can, you know, if I had a pressing deadline, I'm sure I could do it in 6. If I'm procrastinating, it might take me 12 months.
Yeah. Well, I write the same way myself. I go through and then go back. But that's not very...
Don't you find it easier that way, Alan? Because,
oh, yeah, totally.
Because
totally.
You don't know what the book is until you finish it, right? You don't know the whole arc of it.
No, it works better for me. And sometimes I'll finish it and then even be working on something else for a couple of weeks, then go back to it and start. You know, it's kind of weird.
Well, that's the way they tell you to do it. You're doing it the right way. Because that way you can let it sit and sort of come at it with fresh eyes. I don't always do that.
No, and I don't always agree that that's the right way. I think it's just I'm a little insane and I do things the wrong way all the time. And I'm surprised that anybody would say that's anything I do would be right. But, yeah. Do you use what you lived in your previous life? Like an engineer, you know, the nuclear subs, all that sort of thing. Do you think that gets into your writing somehow?
I don't generally make it an overt. I don't try to do it overtly. So I don't think, all right, I'm going to write a book about, you know, an engineer who goes back to business school and then he murders all his engineering fellows because he doesn't like engineering. No, I don't do like that. I think... whenever there's maybe a technical issue, like in Pray for the Innocent, for instance, some people have called it a techno thriller. There's a little bit of technology and stuff in there. I find it a little more conversant in that than maybe someone who hasn't gone through engineering school, but I don't, so at times it does, but it's not something I have relied on in the past. People have suggested I should do more of that, so maybe I should listen to some of those people.
No, don't listen to them. No, forget it. No. No, I was just wondering, because sometimes people's, what they were doing in their day-to-day life, sometimes it kind of, you know, gets in, seeps into how they write.
I wish that in my real life had been a private investigator or police detective or something like that, because then I'd be a lot more comfortable writing some of those procedural type things. You know, I grew up in the suburbs in a very sheltered life. I don't really have much experience with that kind of stuff. In fact, I took a Citizens Police Academy to learn about what they did. You know, at first I thought I would get more experience with crime. So I knocked over a 7-Eleven.
You won't tell anyone.
Instead of doing that. And that taught me a lot of stuff. But still, you know, there's some really great writers out there who are from law enforcement. And they just know their stuff. And I would just be a little intimidated, I guess, really, to try to write in that arena.
Yeah, I guess. A lot of them really know their stuff, their procedure, but they don't have the, I don't know how to say, they just don't have the...
experience writing, yeah.
Yeah, and the words and the way of saying things, maybe, that don't sound too too formulated, you know, too scripted almost. I don't know, you know. So... when you finish a book like this, do you find that it makes, how do I say this? Do you find that it changes you and you notice it in your next book? Like, do you learn something from each book is what I guess I'm trying to get at.
Yeah. I mean, I learned something from I hope I learn something from everything I do. Yeah, you know, each book has taught me something, and I'm not sure I could point specifically to what each book has taught me. But I definitely believe that I'm a better writer now than I was when I first started. You know, certainly from a prose level, from an overall composition level, certainly from plotting. Yeah, I mean, I'm just, you know, sometimes I go back and I'm reissuing some of my earlier books, because I got the rights back and I put on new covers and so on. So I've had an opportunity to read some of those, you know, doing some proofing and so on. And I can definitely see a difference in my writing. It's a lot tighter now. It's a lot crisper, which is good. I mean, I think that evolution, I think most writers probably go through some sort of evolution like that.
Does it make you want to rewrite some of your earlier books?
If it wasn't so much effort, I would consider it. But, you know, I've already plowed those fields. And, you know, so that's the question, right? When you're reissuing these books, you're tempted to, I'm going to rewrite the scene. But then it's like, well, if I rewrite this scene, I have to rewrite the next scene. And then, so then you're going to rewrite the whole book. And then, you know, my first book came out in 2010. So it's not like it's a long time ago, but it's a long enough time ago that certain things have changed, like cell phones. They had cell phones 10 years ago. I went back and I noticed that every time I said it, I would say cell phone. Now people just say phone. Most people have dropped a cell. I don't know about everybody, but so that's one instance with that book that I went through and I did a universal check on cell and I deleted all the cells. So that was my one concession to modernizing the 10-year-old stuff. But some of the references, you know, the pop culture references, certainly dated as being 10 years ago. And I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to put my stake in the ground and say this book was published in 2010 and yes, there were still some phone booths around back then.
Yeah. I'm wondering, you've written a good amount of short fiction. Do you prefer to write short fiction, long fiction? Do you have a preference? Do you consider yourself a natural short fiction writer or natural novelist, all things being equal?
Yeah, no, I like that question. When I started writing fiction, which I was a numbers guy all along. I just started writing fiction, well, it's been 15 years ago now. So it wasn't, I mean, it was, just yesterday I started writing fiction. Now 15 years ago. But for most of my life, I didn't even consider writing fiction. So when I decided to write, I thought I would be a novelist. So the first, I must have written 5 or 6 or 7 manuscripts and had a couple published before the notion of writing a short story even occurred to me. And I was looking around and one of the great things about the mystery writing community, the crime fiction writing community, is how generous and how welcoming and how warm all the other writers are. It's amazing. And a lot of my friends were writing short fiction. And I always kind of wondered what the attraction to that was. And then, so I said, you know, what's the deal? I'm like, well, you can get quick feedback, right? You don't have to wait.
Yep.
First of all, it doesn't take you, you know, 10 months to a year to write a short story. You can write a short story in a couple of weeks or less.
Absolutely.
And then you submit it and you get feedback sometimes in a week, depending on the market you're sending it to, or certainly certainly much faster than when you start submitting to agents and then to editors, like incredibly so. And there are a lot more markets. And what I found is you can be a lot more experimental. Like in my long fiction, in my novels, I wouldn't really consider writing a protagonist that is unlikable because it takes 10 months or whatever to write this. And I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to be a down. I don't want to be down for 10 months writing this guy who's a jerk and what can I do? I want to write someone who's, you know, up the thing or has got some good qualities and is a, you know, a hero. But in the short fiction, I can spend 2 or 3 weeks writing from the viewpoint of a jerk off. It's not a problem for me. So a lot of my short fiction is noir. It's darker. The protagonists are bad guys, which is kind of fun to write every so often. And I enjoy it immensely now. And, you know, I've been lucky. I've had some good success writing short stories, you know, maybe the majority of the stories I've written have found homes somewhere. And it's nice to it keeps your name out there between books. And, you know, if you're lucky, you can get an award nomination or something, which is kind of icing on the cake. And you reach you can reach different subsets of readers. Like different people will read short stories who will read novels and vice versa. And so I think it's great. I'm loving writing short stories.
I guess I won't be. I'll just be in your short stories. Couldn't be in a long story.
You could be the victim.
Oh, yeah. I've been a victim for 60 years now. Come on. Like, what comes up next for you?
Well, you know, I've always got some, you know, publishing, as you know, is, it's a crazy business, and there are tremendously long lead times. So as nice as it is to get a short story with the short lead times, sort of the opposite is true when you're writing a novel. So at any one time, I might have a novel that I'm working on. I might have a novel that I'm revising to get ready for publication, or I might have a novel that's being on submission, and I might have a, you know, I mean, so all throughout. So I have a novel that's on submission. I have a novel that's done that we haven't decided what to do with. I've got a proposal for a novel that's ready to go, and I've got some short stories I've got ideas for. So a lot of stuff's going on at the very moment.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
I just turned in a novella that I think we will be seeing next year. It's part of the Guns and Tacos series, which is edited by a guy named Michael Bracken and co-editor Trey Barker. And it's got a cool premise. They're novellas, and they publish you know, I think it's six a year under the same series. And they all begin with a scene where a character is at a taco truck ordering. It's a taco truck that you buy weapons at, not tacos.
Ah.
And that's how it, in Chicago, and that's how it all these kick off. And then from there, they go in different ways, different subgenres, you know, sci-fi or horror-ish or thriller or caper or heist or noir or whatever. So it's kind of a cool series. So I just finished that and I just turned that in. So I'm just sort of taking a little time off at the moment.
Cool. Is there, I'm just wondering, you're writing thriller and mystery, noir. Are there any other genres that you're interested in trying your hand at? Or
yes, in fact, and David, I you might be interested in this. I wrote a horror novel.
Oh.
And, you know, I think it's probably my favorite book that I wrote. I mean, it came closest to the vision. You know how you have a vision before you begin, and then you start writing, and it veers off the vision a little bit sometimes. And I consider a book to be a success if I can get really close to my vision or exceed my vision. And I think this horror novel kind of even exceeded what I had envisioned when I started to write it. So I really like horror. So,
well, I think there's a real connection between crime and horror.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, in fact, one of my manuscripts that's sitting on my hard drive is sort of a horror thriller that hopefully will find a home sometime, somewhere, someplace. But the one I wrote, it's called The Taste. That was so much fun to write. It was great.
Do you actually act out the scenes? Do you?
I don't act the scenes out. I don't think that would be a good idea for that particular novel.
Well, do you like to put yourself in a place of something you're writing about? Like if you're writing about a certain town or city, something's going on and some sort of, fiction story, do you need to be in that area to absorb the city like some people do?
I don't. I generally, however, write about places that I'm pretty familiar with. So, you know, a lot of my books take place in Northern Virginia where I lived for most of my life. You know, places I go on vacation sometimes I'll set scenes in, like Las Vegas, or my son lives in L.A., so sometimes I'll have an L.A. Scene. So I'm not bold enough to write about a place that I haven't at least been to. Although now with Google and Google Earth and, you could probably get away with doing a pretty good job just that way. But, yeah, I mean, there's something to be said, as you're suggesting, to being there, to kind of absorbing. You don't really know what you're missing until what's there until you go there. And there'll be a certain aroma at a certain, like in Italy, at one of the famous, like Trevi Fountain or something. There might be a certain aroma there that like the bushes or smell like something that you would really only know if you visited. So. So I think I'm going to go to Italy next. Thanks for that for idea.
Yeah, it's a good write-off. Yeah, it's a good write-off.
Good idea.
Well, after you were just talking about going on a break, you know, taking a little bit of a break. After you write something, do you have a way to decompress or a way to recharge? Is there something that you do? Do you typically just go right into the next story? How does that work for you?
You know, I'm a pretty chill guy. So I don't really get that stressed out. You know, after writing, it's like, okay, well, you know, I'll just live, keep going as normal. Usually there's a break between, you know, I catch my breath kind of thing before I start on something else. But, you know, if I've got a deadline or something, I'll just plow ahead. So, sorry, I know you wanted some answers. Where, you know, run naked okay. Streets at midnight, screaming. Or
something. Yeah.
No, that's just not me. So. No,
you just do that for fun.
Yeah. Right. That's in the middle of my book when I'm having some plotting issues. Yeah. That's when I go naked running through the streets.
There you go. See, now we're getting into the real stuff.
Yeah.
Like, let's get into the real. Yes. Like, none of this fake stuff. You know, fake news. You know, who do you want to work with? Or do you?
You mean like co-write something?
Yeah. Or run naked.
No, I think it would be so. I think it would be so much fun to co-write, if not a book, at least some stories with some of my friends. And every time I approach them, they kind of give me the, Oh, yeah, Alan, that's a good idea. Look, I'm real busy now. You know, talk to me in a few months. And they always say that, and I'm not sure what that means exactly. no, but it would be very cool to do some co-writing, and mostly with my friends. You know, I can't. I got some friends that are good writers, and it would be kind of fun to, you know, maybe do an alternate viewpoint kind of story where we each take a character and kind of wind it together. I don't know, something. That'd be fun.
Yeah, it's certainly a different way of doing something. I would imagine it would be tough to decide on how a character's going to act when you have two people trying to decide.
Yeah.
Unless you're exactly on the same page, you know what I mean? Because
yeah, although, you know, a lot of people do it, and they say it's not as hard as you might think. So I don't know. It'd be fun to try. I'm game for anything. And if James Patterson wants to co-write with me, that'd be fine.
Well, I'll give him a call.
I'll have him on speed dial. Have you read anything, or do you have any influences that might be surprising to fans?
I don't know about surprising, but as I mentioned, I like horror, and as a kid, as a teenager in English class, I was never really drawn to the so-called classics, James Joyce and William Faulkner, and some of those guys that are supposedly wrote some stuff. I don't know. I did whatever I could to avoid reading those things. You know, I was
me too.
Cliff's Notes. But I was a big reader, and I used to read a lot of Stephen King and Dean Koontz and a lot of sci-fi. So Robert Heinlein and Isaac Asimov and Frederick Pohl and a lot of those, you know, some of those guys. And I think that they have influenced my writing, even these many years, even in a different genre, even many years later. It's not to say that, you know, Robert B. Parker, he was a big influence. You know, I read Agatha Christie again in the younger days, and I think, you know, a lot of these. I mean, I think you like when you write every time you write a book, you learn something. I think every time I read something, even if it's good, I learn the good things to do, and if it's bad, I learn the things that maybe I should avoid. So I think, you know, anytime you pick up a book or a story or whatever, you can learn something from it. And, you know, my TBR pile is just huge. And there are just so many great writers out there writing not only crime fiction, but other stuff. And, you know, I could read from when I wake up in the morning till I go to bed at night, I would hardly make a dent in my pile.
I know the feeling, yeah.
Well, and who is the Stephen King guy?
Yeah. Never heard of him.
He's an obscure writer. you might know him as Joe Hill's father.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll have to look for that. I don't know. But you know, you're supposed to say the hosts are the best that you've been reading.
My hosts are the best podcasters. I can't think of any better podcasters. How's that?
Good. Well, you know. I don't know. What do you think of the publishing world right now?
Wow, you know,
putting you on the spot.
That's about what I think of it.
No,
you know, it's I only have, you know, my little view, my little peephole into the world. So it's hard for me to say what the publishing, you know, world in broad looks like. I think the pandemic has kind of thrown people, I don't want to say for a loop, but I think it's affected people, their productivity, and I'm speaking of in sort of a general terms of writers and maybe agents and editors. It sort of put a damper on things. You know, a lot of my friends who write, they've had trouble putting the words on the paper, so to speak. You know, their creativity might be a little bit down. And I've at times found similar things. So, you know, the past year and a half, I think have been hard for a lot of people in the business. Mm. And, you know, we're still seeing effects. There's paper shortages. So some of the books are getting delayed. You know, the release dates are getting delayed. And although a lot of the editors and so on were working from home through the pandemic, I'm not sure how efficient they have been. So there's a lot of backlogs in meeting submissions, I think. So it's just been slow. The last year and a half, I think, have been slow. And a lot of the writing conferences have been canceled. So I think that's also kind of put a damper on things. You know, it's Zoom is great for what it is, but it's not really a full substitute for being at the bar, meeting your friends, networking with new writers and people in the industry, learning what new projects are out there and so on. So from an energy level, I think the energy in the publishing world over the last year and a half has been diminished.
So do you think that's primarily the pandemic or the emotions going on in the country that causes that?
Well, you know, I don't want to get political, but there's been a lot of divisiveness. And I think that also has contributed to, that's probably also a contributing factor. So, yeah, in the last X number of years, from a zeitgeist,
yeah.
Maybe things have been a little bit down. Maybe that's a good observation.
Do you think that? But it seems to me like you're the type of guy that, so you actually plan your day, right? So you have a time period where you're going to write.
And well, it's 5:40. It's time for my pre-dinner cocktail. Sorry.
And your cigar.
Go ahead.
Well, I mean, it seems to me like you put time aside every day to do a certain amount of writing, and you can sit there and do it, and it's effective for you. Is that correct?
When I'm working on a project, that's correct.
So you can, in essence, you can just turn it on, so to speak.
Well, you know, I mean, I try. Now, every time I sit down, sometimes the words are just horrible. In fact, I'll say to my wife, I just finished my quota, and those are the worst 1,200 words I've ever written. And she'll say, well, you said that yesterday, and the day before, and the day before. I'm like, well, today I really mean it.
So that means you're getting worse per day.
So, I mean, people say, oh, you know, I have writer's block, or I'm waiting for the muse before I can sit down and get my words done. Well, there's no plumber's block. If you call a plumber, it's not like, well, I'm just not feeling it today, Alan. I'll come unclog your toilet tomorrow. How's that work for you? So I try to approach writing, again, when I'm in the project mode, as sort of a job. And sometimes I don't want to go to work some days. So I sit down and I type my 1,200 words. And if I get to word 1,200 and I'm in the middle of a sentence and I am not feeling it, I'll get up right in the middle of the sentence and say, I'm off to do something else. That's how it works. But I think it helps when my expectations of when I write a first draft, I don't have any. I know it's going to be crappy, so I just sit down, write my words, and I get up. I don't agonize it. They're too crappy. I just know they're going to be crappy, and I'll deal with it later.
Oh, exactly. It's like me. I just know that it's going to be crappy even when it gets published.
That's not knowledge.
No, I don't even think about it. I run. But in your situation, see, because I can't quite do it that way. I can't just go, well, I've got 3 hours clear today and I've got to do so many words. That never works for me, ever. So I wonder if you can just... I don't know how to say this. Are you more in touch with your emotions or what? Like, I'm trying to picture that type of writing, or you just kind of do it. And then at the end of the draft, you kind of go through it and get rid of the ones that don't work.
Yeah. Yeah. I am not kidding that it's crappy. I mean, it's really bad. Now, I will say that I am extremely fortunate that I have a wife who has supported the family for all these many years. So I've not been pressed into having the pressure of having a day job at times and so on. So I have the time to spend on my writing. And I know most people probably are not as fortunate as I am in that respect. So, if I say I sit down for 2.5 hours and write my 1500 words, I realize that many people don't have 2.5 hours to do that. So, it could take me a lot less time to write it than someone who's got a day job and the young kids at home and so on. So I fully realize that I'm fortunate, but I just, it's one of those things where I know that when I get my quota done, I can get up and do something I enjoy. So I'll, I can go exercise, or I can, read one of those many books I have lying around that I want to read, or I can go play golf.
Running for pizza, make it.
Or go get something to eat, or whatever. So
have a cocktail.
Have a cocktail. No, actually, I don't imbibe. I'm not a much of a drinker. But no, really. So you get in the habit. It's sort of like you get in the habit, and I know it's going to take me a couple hours. And every once in a while, you write that great sentence, and you're like, yes, that's why I'm sitting here for 2 hours, for that one sentence.
What do you think your most important book is?
My most important book?
Yeah, that you've written.
I try to write for entertainment. So I've taken a lot of pressure off myself by not having to write something that I feel is important or has some kind of social message. I don't set out to write those kind of books. Now, what I do find is that once I'm into the book, 60, 80,000 words, whatever, certain themes arise. So there are social themes in my work. And then in the revision process, I sort of try to fine tune them and bring them out a little more. So, but I want to emphasize that I'm writing to give people an escape. If I happen to give them something to think about, it's a little more something more to chew on than just a plot and some fun characters. That's great. But I don't really set out to write a message book. I don't think I have the chops to do that. I know a lot of writers do, and they do a great job, but I'm not really, it's not in my wheelhouse, I don't think. Pray for the Innocent sort of takes a look at technology run amok a little bit. So I think there's sort of that theme that runs through it that I thought was pretty interesting. Some of my other books, a couple of my other books have dealt with father-son relationships that I thought were interesting to explore. I Know Where You Sleep deals with there's a stalker involved. So that's a little more concrete, where it deals with sort of what a victim of a stalking episode might feel and go through in the despair and the depths of what she might try to extricate herself from that situation. So, like I said, I don't start out with a message book, exactly, but there's something in probably most of my books where it'll make you think a little more.
And I've been waiting for a year. You said, you know where I sleep. I've been waiting for some stalking going on here, and I don't get it.
One of these days, Alan. One of these days when you least expect
it. Oh, that's good. I like it that way. Wow. I mean, speaking of stalking, how do you like people to stalk you? Like, do you have an address or phone number you want to get out?
On Facebook. I'm stalkable on Twitter. I do Instagram a little bit, but I'm not real photograph oriented. I'm more word oriented. So I'm still kind of learning Instagram a little bit. And I have a website, of course, alanorloff.com. You can stalk me there. And you can send me an email. I'm always looking for ways to procrastinate. So send me an email with, like, you know, 20 or 30 detailed questions I have to answer. Beautiful. I'm good for the morning.
Well, now we know how to do it. Did the pandemic make you write darker? Did you find that you got a little bit deeper and darker in your writing? Or,
you know, after I wrote The Taste, which was 7 or 8 years ago or 9 years ago, where it's cannibalism is involved, I'm not sure I could get any darker than that. So, no, I don't think it's affected the timbre of what I've been writing. A lot of people it has, absolutely. But I was, we were moving. We sold our house in we moved out of our house in January of 2020. And our plan was to move to Florida, where I now live, and stay in Airbnbs or whatever for a couple months while we found a house. Well, we put that plan into action, and kind of right in the middle of it all was the pandemic, the shutdown. So we ended up having to live in a hotel for a month. And I do not recommend living in a hotel for a month. And, you know, cramped up in a little room, that's enough to make you everything go dark. But luckily, here in Florida, we could go outside. Like, if we'd been in Virginia during the pandemic shutdown and everything, we would be, you know, stuck in the house. But here, you know, the weather's great. And so that all was good. So we moved into our new neighborhood, and because of the pandemic, we didn't really meet our neighbors, except from like 30 feet away, right? With, you know, unmasked. So I have, you know, I moved down here. I didn't have a doctor, so I went to the doctor. I don't know what my internist looks like. Well, I don't know. The two times I've seen him, he's masked. I don't know what he looks like. How weird is that to have a doctor? You know, your primary care physician, you even know what he looks like.
Probably not a real doctor, you know, telling you to take that, horse dewormer, then you know he's not.
Horse dewormer.
Yeah, stay away from that. My God. Well, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and good to hear what's going on in your world. I mean, geez, you're a real, real good writer. People love you. So.
Well, thank you, Alan. Again, thanks for having me back. And I would have to say that this time was equally, if not more fun than last time. So.
Oh, okay. It must have been David, you know.
I was gonna say David made things better, but John is a good friend of mine.
Yeah, so you better not say that.
I don't want to say that.
No.
So I say it's at least as much fun.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well,
you know.
Thank you.
There you go. See, yeah, I'm telling you, he's a star. He's a star.
Oh, yeah.
Well, anyway, our guest has been the great Alan Orloff. And, of course, the book is called I Play One on TV. And he does. So thank you for being here.
Thanks again for having me. It's a pleasure.
Thanks, Alan.
Tired of wasting time trying to decide what to watch on your streaming service? Go to our website and look for the Martino Movie Reviews.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.